This podcast is supported by The Real Real. You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention that everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
This episode is brought to you by Prep Starts Now, because life doesn't come with a warning. When an emergency strikes, whether it's a power outage, natural disaster, or even a medical scare, the last thing you want is panic. Prep Start Now empowers families to be ready with the right tools, knowledge, and confidence. They're about smart planning so you can focus on protecting your family instead of scrambling for solutions. Their shop has everything from first aid kits and water filtration to backup power and essential gear. Plus, their Prep Academy makes it easy to learn emergency skills with simple guides and quick tips anyone can follow. I've arranged an exclusive 15% discount for my listeners. Just go to PrepStartsNow.com and use promo code ZEROSIGNAL at checkout, or click the link in my show notes where the discount is applied automatically. Don't wait for the next crisis. Take action today. That's PrepStartsNow.com. Promo code ZEROSIGNAL.
You're tuned into Zero Signal, a show about what they won't say and what you're probably already thinking. No fluff, no filters, no bullshit. Let's crack it open.
At this time, I'm going to ask you to fasten your seatbelts.
Welcome back to Zero Signal. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and drop a comment. It really helps the channel grow. So Jay, have you ever noticed how Mount Shasta isn't just a mountain? You look it up, and three clicks later, you're knee-deep in UFOs, ascended masters, and underground cities. It's like Wikipedia got possessed by a seance.
Yeah, man. It's one of those places that looks calm on the outside, but the second you start reading about it, you realize people think it's basically the Earth's USB port to the cosmos.
Yeah, that's accurate. You got spiritual retreats, cults, vanishings, orbs, light, really the works. There's something about the mountain that makes people want to find out that meaning in the mist.
Yeah, it seems to be a magnet for the new age. You got yogis, crystal healers, UFO hunters, and full-on believers setting up shop right next to the regular hikers who just came to view and mount the summit.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And in between all of that, you get the stories. The guy who says he met an immortal alchemist up there, that's where one of America's biggest new age movements really started.
The whole quote-unquote I am activity. You also have a little bit of Saint Germain, violet flames, ascension decrees. It's wild how one hiking story turned into a full-blown spiritual empire.
And man, that's just the start. The mountain's seen generations of groups since then. Light families, energy healers, doomsday prophets, all claiming the same thing. The mountain smoke to them.
Yeah, man. The craziest part is it never stops. Every decade, there's a new version that pops up. The only thing that seems to change color are the robes, the language, and the idea is the same. Shasta is isn't just sacred, it's awake, according to these people.
And tonight we're going to dig into all of that. The faith, the fanatics, the people who found themselves, and the ones who lost everything trying. Maybe we start with a brief history and get into a bit of Lemurian myth.
Let's do it.
So long before the UFO lights, the metaphysical retreats, Shasta rose from fire and ruin. It's a stratovolcano, 14,163 feet high, built over hundreds of thousands of years by eruptions and collapse. Beneath it lies the bones of an older mountain that crumbled in a cataclysmic event, a landslide about a half a million years ago. Black Butte and Shastina, its twin cones, grew from the rubble 11 millennia ago. The last known eruption around 3,200 years past dusted the sky with ash and molten glass. Today, the volcano rests under a crown of glaciers, breathing only faint wisps of steam, quiet but not dead. The U.S. Geological Survey watchers, it is like a sleeping giant, instruments buried in the rock to listen for the tremors. Mount Shasta rises from the Siskiyou County in far northern California, about 60 miles south of the Oregon border and 230 miles north of Sacramento. It anchors the southern end of the Cascade Range, which is surrounded by forest, lakes, and the small towns of Mount Shasta, McLeod, Weed, and Dunsmuir. The travelers on Interstate 5, it appears suddenly, an immense white pyramid against the sky, visible from more than about 100 miles away. For the Pitt River, the Kurek and Shasta and Wintu peoples, the mountain is older than the planet's memory. It's a pillar of creation, a living ancestor, a place where the sky and earth were joined. Panther Meadow remains their sacred altar. They call it a birthplace of the world itself. To them, the stories of portals and the lightships are echoes of something far deeper. Shasta has always been this bridge, just not the kind tourists imagine. The mountain's modern name took shape in the 19th century when the Hudson's Bay Company trapper Peter Ogden mapped it in 1827. Spellings wavered, Shasta, Shasti, and multiple other variants, until about 1850 when Mount Shasta finally stuck. By then, the gold rush had begun and legends had started to grow. And the mountain's long double life as both geological marvel and mythic engine was already sealed. Now, the big map is of the Lemurians. Do you know anything about the Lemurians?
So the term Lemuria didn't start as like a metaphysical or occult concept at all, though it did transition into that. The term Lemuria was coined by a fellow by the name of Philip Scatlater. He was a British zoologist specializing in mammals and birds. In 1864, he published The Mammals of Madagascar in the Quarterly Journal of Science. This is an interesting fact. He noted that lemurs only existed in Madagascar and India, but not in Africa or the Middle East. He explained this by proposing a new submerged landmass connecting Madagascar to southern India and perhaps western Australia, and he called that missing landmass Lemuria. So Lemuria began as a biogeographical hypothesis, essentially an early attempt to explain species migrations before the plate tectonics or the continental drift were understood. So the term was eventually adopted by 19th century naturalists. So a fellow by the name of Ernst Haeckel, he was a German evolutionary biologist, and he suggested Lemuria as the cradle of humanity where the first men might have evolved. Also a scientist by the name of Alfred Wallace, co-founder of evolutionary theory, mentioned but rejected Lemuria, favoring other land bridge explanations. And then Thomas Huxley briefly referenced the continent between India and Africa in his early geological speculation. By the 1880s, the whole continental drift theory came about and it made such a continent unnecessary, and the scientific community pretty much dropped the whole concept of Lemuria. A theosophist by the name of Helena Blavatsky actually picked up the term Lemuria and she appropriated the name. So from a land bridge to an ancient spiritual continent, that's how the whole transition happened. She was an occultist. She founded theosophy. The term theosophy encompasses two words, theos, which is God, and sophia, which is wisdom. So it literally means divine wisdom. It's not a single religion, but a worldview that combines elements of Eastern mysticism, Western esotericism, and occult philosophy. So she founded this religion, philosophy in the late 19th century. She was a Russian mystic and author who co-founded the Theosophical Society in 1875. So I think this is a big part of the reason that Mount Shasta is considered such a new age kind of hippie type thing. This is where some of the theories are mixed in with occult viewpoints and maybe a little bit blown out of proportion, because these people believe in universal brotherhood, karma, and reincarnation. They believe in these hidden masters, esoteric wisdom, and unity of science, religion, and philosophy, which is a red flag for me, because that points to revelation and the world government, one world religion. So this is almost a precursor to some of this one world type stuff.
So it always comes back to the Russians. It's always an interesting concept. We've seen them in Antarctica. We've seen them in multiple places when we talk about these conspiracy theories. But you talked about our teachings, the secret doctrine, which was written in 1888. It transformed those proto-geological musings into this kind of sacred history. She wrote that the Lemurians were a mighty root race, immense in stature, psychic in perception, and far older than recorded time. They commune telepathically, mastered crystal technology, and lived in harmony with the planet until the Great Cataclysm, volcanic, tidal, and perhaps karmic, dragged their civilization beneath the Pacific. Later, esoteric traditions declared that not all perished. Survivors, guided by higher beings, fled inland to preserve their culture. The tallest, brightest, and most spiritually advanced sought refuge inside the Mountain of Power, Mount Shasta. There, they built Telios, a hidden city carved in crystal and gold, its halls glowing with light that never fades. Over the centuries, these Lemurians became immortal stewards of our secret wisdom, emerging rarely to guide the surface world when it strayed too far from its balance. Mount Shasta's mythology really described them as tall, graceful beings, robed in white and radiant calm. Hikers tell of fleeting encounters, figures glimpsed through the trees, footprints that started to vanish, and a voice in the wind that seemed both distant and kind. Now, these New Age movements treat them as ascended mentors, channeling messages of planetary healing and cosmic unity. To some, the Lemurians are the missing link between the ancient myth and the alien contact, and to others, they are symbols of spiritual endurance, a race that survived disaster, not by fleeing outward, but inward, into the heart of the earth, kind of like that hollow earth theory that we hear a whole lot about. Whether history, allegory, or hope, I think their legend has fused forever with Mount Shasta's now snow-bright summit. The mountain, they say, still hums with their memory. Listen long enough and you might hear it, a low vibration, deep as the ocean that they once called home. The Lemurians is really an interesting concept. I'm not convinced I believe in it, but it comes back to what we've heard about is the continents being united. I think the original theory was called Pangaea, where all the continents were united. Some say when the Great Flood happened, the seas burst from below and separated these continents. I think this is maybe another retelling of that story of how all of society and all peoples in the world were connected at one time. I know they point to now discarded 19th century philosophy that a missing landmass had once linked Asia, Africa, and Australia, explaining that spread of similar fossils across the oceans. I know that ideal slipped from geology into myth when spiritualists and theosophists adopted it, claiming Lemuria wasn't just a continent, it was humanity's first cradle, much like we see now with the Middle East. So it's a really interesting claims and groups. But what we find is that there's a whole lot of interesting things going over on Mount Shasta that people have claimed for a very long time up into including modern history. What are some interesting lore or myths or perhaps reality that you heard of? What's that one that stands out to you?
Yeah, before I go into that, I just kind of want to circle back to this Helena Blavatsky lady, the theosophist. It's interesting how she apparently got her knowledge of this. So she claimed to have gotten her hand on an ancient book written in Zenzar, a secret language known only to adepts in the Brotherhood of Tibet. It was called the Stanzas of Dizen. So she got instructions of how to translate this from the masters of wisdom, from the Mahatmas, who she said trained her during her years in Tibet and communicated telepathically afterward, and through clairvoyant perception, her own and that of initiates who could perceive past ages through the Akashic records. So like back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, you had this big spiritualist movement with a lot of mediums and psychic readers, and a lot of this kind of stemmed from her. So my radar starts to ping when I hear somebody translating quote-unquote ancient texts with the help of quote-unquote masters and through automatic writing and telepathy. To me, that is a bunch of satanic BS and somebody who is messing with the demonic realm. And right there, in my head, throws the whole concept of Lemuria out the door. She did talk about Atlantis. She did talk about other civilizations. And it's not that I don't agree that Atlantis didn't exist. I do think it probably existed in some form of fashion, just like Lumeria. I don't know if these people are talking about the same kind of pre-flood one world civilization, and they're all just naming it different things. Every culture may have a different name for it, even though I think the term Lumeria, we pretty much find where it came from. It came from a guy trying to explain how lemurs ended up in some parts of the world, but not others. And he explained it by this submerged continent. But I just wanted to point that out to the listeners, that when you're getting information for somebody who claims to be a clairvoyant, who has their hands on secret quote unquote documents and are learning from quote unquote masters of wisdom, it always throws up that red flag for me.
Masters of the universe. I think of He-Man whenever time I hear that. Some of those things are just bizarre. And what they're talking about and what we see as a reoccurring theme throughout our history is people are trying to create this kind of perfect race that has command over everything. They talk about Lemuria as this vast Pacific continent that birthed humanity's earliest race. When Lemuria sank, its most advanced beings supposedly migrated inland, building these new sanctuaries in the mountains. They said later generations of mystics gave those refugees a postal address, which was Mount Shasta. Here, the Lemurians became the architects of Telios, a subterranean city of crystal halls and radiant gardens. Channelers claim to converse with their high priest, Adama, who teaches love, peace, and the eventual reunion of the surface and inner worlds. What began as this 19th century metaphysical allegory turned into the 20th century tourism phenomenon, past scripture, part science fiction, and entirely Shasta. That leap from her root race myth to this kind of modern new age geography made the mountain a living chapter in the alternative prehistory. To believers, Telios is proof that enlightenment didn't just vanish with the floods. It simply moved underground, waiting for humanity to evolve enough to find its front door. It's interesting that we're talking about the flood again. We see it with Atlantis. We see it with Noah. We see it across the world. And sometimes I wonder if it's just a retelling and a reversioning of what God gave us in the first place. Like, you're always talking about the core themes. And perhaps if you don't believe in God and you experience the event, you're not quite sure what to call it in your history books as you're about to drown and writing your logs, and hopefully it saves it.
Yeah, I also want to point to a guy named Frederick Spencer Oliver. He wrote a book on Mount Shasta and a bunch of other lost civilizations. And he claimed that he did automatic writing through Philos the Tibetan. So there's no real archaeological or historical verification for the specific technologies or civilizations he describes. But again, we have another theosophist, a guy who was influenced by Beth Lasky and who is heavy into the new cult and new age. And he came up with a lot of...
This podcast is supported by The Real Real. You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention that everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
The myth stories he built up on him through his writings. And again, he did it claiming that he channeled a master, which in my book, you're channeling a demonic presence who's going to lie to you. Sometimes I think when people channel these beings or spirits, there might be some half-truths in there. They might throw out 10 facts to you. One may be truth, maybe two, but the other 8 or 9 are lies. So it just blows my mind that there's so much occult, so much esoteric stuff that's associated with this mountain and some of the myths in it.
Yeah, there's a lot of cult activity that goes on there. Have you heard of the Shasta-Sedona ley line?
I haven't. Tell me.
So if you trace the invisible map that believers call Earth's energy grid, a single bright current runs from Mount Shasta in Northern California all the way to Red Rocks of Sedona, Arizona. Now, they say this shimmering path is said to pass the Grand Grand Canyon, Pyramid Lake, and the dry Nevada desert, whispered to hide Area 51. To those who map by magnetism and myth, Shasta and Sedona are twin nodes, two ends of a spiritual wire kind of humming beneath the continent. Visitors to either place describe the same sensations when they visit. Meditation that hits like altitude, air that vibrates, time that bends. Healers talk about alignments during solstice, when the line between the two mountains fires, connecting their vortexes in a pulse of planetary energy. Skeptics call it coincidence, but pilgrims bring copper pendulums and compasses anyways, watching needles twitch as the heart races. Whether it's geology, geomancy, or the imagination, the Shasta-Sedona line is more than a route. It's a legend written across the landscape, linking two deserts by a current you can't quite see, but you can almost feel. I was watching one of my favorite YouTubers that were exploring this area in Sedona, and they were venturing out. They met a couple of locals near the Sedona ley line, and there was a couple of hippies that approached them, and they gave them all of these copper trinkets to take with them to Mount Shasta, saying it was going to be some type of dedication or something that would protect them. So there are a lot of believers out there that I would classify as a cult that believe that these things are linked together, that they're two things that are transitioning as one and are connected by this mythical energy field. And I think we go back to 1888 when we talk about the occipist, but it's all weird. And I don't know where they're always actually getting it, but you're right. If they're in communion with what they call the master or some type of dominion spirit that gave them misinformation, it sounds pretty suspect in my book.
Yeah. So have you heard about J.C. Brown's Secret Tunnel and Giant Mummy's Tale?
Oh, this is a good one. Yeah. Go into
Yeah. I'll start it off. And if I miss something, pop in. So in 1904, British prospector J.C. Brown allegedly discovered an 11-mile tunnel inside of Mount Shasta while working for the Lord Cowdrey Mining Company. So this guy was essentially looking for gold, and he claimed, as he was prospecting around, he found a tunnel, a rather large tunnel. And he's like, whatever, I'll go in there, see what's in there. So he claimed to have traveled 11 miles inside this tunnel. And he said the passage led to a hidden village filled with gold nuggets, copper shields, some strange hieroglyphs, jade tablets. And he claimed that there were 27 mummified giants ranging from 6'6" to 10 feet tall. And he claimed that these giants of this lost civilization had advanced tools. And it appears that they had a pretty advanced society, and that seemingly they revered the mountain as sacred. Brown apparently kept this secret for 30 years. Then in 1934, he shared the tale with a journalist named John C. Root, who hyped it up in the Los Angeles Times. So he eventually got an expedition of 80 plus people, including scientists and apparently a museum curator, and they assembled in Stockton, California. And to get 80 people to come, he promised a portion of the treasure that they would find. There are stories about people selling their houses, selling everything they own, in order to get the gear to go on this expedition. So they assembled on June 19, 1934, and the day that they were supposed to go, Brown vanished without a trace. So I'll let you pick it up from there.
Yeah, the story really electrified a town. Brown promised to lead this expedition, and dozens of volunteers packed tools, food, lanterns, ready to uncover the lost world of Lemuria. But on the morning they were to depart, Brown vanished. No farewell, no footprints, just an empty hotel room, and then a legend that never stopped breathing. Some say he was silenced by the same forces that hide Telios. Others think he found something he shouldn't have and never returned. The truth remains buried within the mountains. Every generation, another seeker claims to have found a hint of the tunnel, an air vent, a sealed shaft, a whisper of gold. None have ever brought proof. But Mount Shasta's mythology and the absence of evidence is the evidence. The door exists. It simply chooses when and for whom it will open. Now, to me, that sounds awfully convenient. It sounds like, and I don't know much about this guy's background, but it sounds like Mr. Brown may have bit off a little bit more than he could chew. He enjoyed the fame. He enjoyed all the people coming together to support his mission down 11 miles into a passage that supposedly ran almost into this hollow earth theory, kind of towards the center of the earth. People were excited. As you said, they sold their homes. They collected all their belongings. They were excited to take part, discover a new society, and get a bunch of gold and become millionaires as they come on the other end of it. But the day they're supposed to leave, Brown's like, you know what? Nothing's actually there. Peace. I'm out. Like, don't don't find me. And it was a lot harder in 1934 to find people once they wanted to be disappeared. So I find that story awfully convenient that people are saying he was silenced. To me, it sounds like a man that perhaps just stretched his imagination a little bit too far. And when he got called to the carpet, he didn't bother showing up.
Yeah, so a little bit about his early life. So there's an interesting documentary by Stephen Sandoni. He investigated this story for a 2009 documentary. Some sources describe J.C. Brown as a millionaire who refused to give his full name. And this kind of fueled speculation that he was hiding a shady past. So Sandoni believes J.C. Brown was an alias for J.B. Boat Body, a retired visitor from out of town with no prior ties to Stockton, California. Body, or if you want to call him Brown, had become fascinated by the occult theories, particularly James Churchward's books on the lost continents of Mu and emerging Lumeria lore. The conclusion of this documentary is that he thinks his obsession with theosophy, lost civilization, inspired him to create this elaborate tale, and he set the backdrop as Mount Shasta, and this is really stoked the fire for this whole Mount Shasta conspiracy, the ancient ruins, the lost technology. And like you said, I lean to the hoax theory. I think this guy was probably well off. He probably had some money, and he probably thought he wasn't going to get as much traction as he was. And by the time he rounded up 80 people, he thought, if I go into that mountain with 80 people and I can't prove that I was here, that the story is true, they're going to kill me and leave me in the mountain crevices. There, like you said before, some people theorize he was murdered. Some claim that Lumerian guardians killed him. Some claim government agents did it. And if I was going to believe any of this murdering theory, I would believe that rival treasure hunters probably killed him to keep secrets. I think this man existed. I don't think he was murdered. I think he just peaced out of the town. And he was never seen from again, obviously. I think because if you're on the west coast of Northern California and you realize that you got yourself in a whole heap of trouble and this lie is caught up with you and you have to bounce out of town, you're going back to England, you're going back to JB Body, and you're just living the rest of your days hoping nobody comes down and tracks you down because you sold your house and all your belongings to get a piece of this treasure that didn't exist.
Everybody else is packing up. They see this guy also packing his belongings, thinking they're going to go on this long journey together. He's just going in the opposite direction. Like, he's peacing out. I can just imagine people putting all this stuff on their backs, and if he did show up and they start climbing this mountain and trying to find this passageway that doesn't exist. Like you said, man, I think he gets murdered up there.
Especially back in 1904. Like, in 1904 in the mountains, like, no one's going to know. Like, he fell off a cliff. I don't know what happened to him.
Yeah. Under a rock. Nobody's going to come looking. It was a vast territory. Probably a lot of it was unexplored at that time even. And yeah, he would disappear real quick. But sticking in the 1900s, one of the big stories that came out was Saint Germain. The Count of Saint Germain was already a legend long before Mount Shasta entered the story. In 18th century Europe, he was known as an alchemist, a composer, a diplomat who never seemed to age. Some said he possessed the Philosopher's Stone. Others called him immortal. His sudden reappearance in the 20th century on a hiking trail in Northern California tied him to European occult history, to the American landscape. In 1930, Guy Ballard claimed he met Saint Germain on the slopes of Shasta. The encounter birthed the I Am activity, fusing theosophic ideals of ascended masters with this patriotic mysticism and self-empowerment. The violent robbed count, who once haunted European salons, now walked in American wilderness, teaching this cosmic law to a nation poised for modernity. Today, followers of the I Am activity and its offshoots still gather near the mountain, lighting these violent flames and reciting decrees to invoke the master's presence. Saint Germain's legend thus spans centuries and continents in this immortal alchemist transplanted from castle halls to volcanic meadows, proving that myth, like the man himself, never truly dies. And maybe he saw the guy you were talking about. Perhaps he saw Saint Germain up there. Maybe Saint Germain knocked him off.
Dang it, Saint Germain. Leave people alone, man. You live forever. Just let people look for treasure. No, the thing I find interesting about Ballard is that he wrote a book in 1934, which coincidentally, I'm not linking the two, but I think it's funny how he wrote a book in 1934 and J.C. Brown, this is when he told his story, it was in 1934 as well. So you have what, in my opinion, is two con artists coming up with these fantastic stories about Mount Shasta in the same year. So he wrote a book called Unveiled Mysteries. It was the first of the Saint Germain series. Ballard described Germain as ageless with a voice like vibrant gold bells, kind of like mine. And the ability to materialize and feast from the thin air. So essentially he's saying this guy can just make filet mignon fall out of the sky and eat it. And he also claims Shasta's etheric energy amplified the encounter, with Germaine explaining the mountain as a nexus for Lumerian survivors. But Germaine claimed that they were from the lost continent of Mu and ascended beings. Here we go with ascended beings again. And like you said, they found the whole I Am movement. So again, another occultist influenced by Theosophist. In the same year that J.C. Brown's telling people this fantastic story about this 11-mile tunnel underneath the mountains full of giants, full of gold and jade tablets, he had this guy meeting Saint Germain just randomly walking in the woods. It's just, it's too coincidental not to be true, bro. You gotta believe it.
I think about the Ascended Master lineage. In cosmology of the Ascended Master teachings, Mount Shasta is really more than a terrain. It's this monastery that's sealed in the stone. Followers of the Summit Lighthouse and related lineages describe a hidden priesthood within the mountain known as the Brotherhood of Mount Shasta. These adepts are said to have tended to the sacred flame of Mu, the lost Pacific continent, since before its fall. When the ocean reclaimed the world, they carried a spiritual fire into the volcano's heart and kept it burning through the centuries of darkness. They say inside Shasta's Crystal's Hall, the Brotherhood holds a vigil, a council of masters, of saints, and Lemurian initiates overseeing the spiritual evolution of the West. And pilgrims describe feeling their presence as a sudden peace or a violent radiance that sweeps through the meadows. In this theology and in this teaching, the Brotherhood connects prehistory and prophecy, the unbroken chain of Mu, and the modern seekers. The mountain's glow at sunset becomes a sign of the silent guardianship, kind of like a beacon for anyone listening beneath the noise of wind and time. So you have these ascended master races, and this ultimate race reminds me of the Nazis. Like, master race, let's march forward. It gets kind of wild, and there's a lot of connected wild stories to this. I do have one that I would love to talk about. It's a little bit further advanced.
I just want to tell you that the I Am movement is still alive and well today. They have a Shasta Springs retreat, a 400-acre property near Dunsmuir, north of Shasta, hosts summer conclaves, youth programs, decree sessions where participants invoke Germaine's violet flame for global healing. They also have the I Am School, it's kindergarten through 12th grade in Mount Shasta City, founded under Germaine's quote-unquote radiation, integrates academics with ascendant master principles like mighty I Am presence. And they also have annual pageants. Maybe you should enter your daughter into one. So they've had these since 1950. The I Am Come pageant, it's a musical drama on Jesus' life, plays at G.W. Ballard Amphitheater in Mount Shasta City. So this foundation still exists. It publishes 21 books in the Saint Germain series distributed worldwide and warns against imposter groups diluting the teachings, the Ascendant Master teachings. And I guess it's all copywritten.
Yeah, man, I don't think I need to enter my daughter. I can.
Dude, you are that beard, man. That thing's killer.
No, cool. I think it brings up a good point, though. Do you want to talk a little bit about what I Am is? Like, what are their teachings? What makes them like a cult?
Yeah. So, you know, they have 7 fundamental truths. The first one is there's only one presence, God, the I Am, which I agree. There is only one real God. The Son is Jesus Christ. 2, your I Am presence is God individualized in you, not a distant deity, but you in perfection. We know we're not perfect and we can't gain perfection through our own deeds or works. We have to accept Jesus Christ as our Lord and Savior. 3, what you think, feel, and say after I Am comes into form. So here, again, something that unfortunately, in my opinion, has crept into some of the modern day church, particularly the prosperity church. So this is just another word, in my opinion, and I think my opinion is spot on. So this is the whole manifestation thing. You can't manifest anything. You can control the way you think. You can believe in God. You can pray, and God's not going to give you everything you want. God will bless you beyond measure, but what's a blessing for me or you or any of our listeners is completely different. So they're proposing this whole manifestation, occult view. 4, the violent flame transmutes all human miscreation. So essentially, it's Saint Germain's gift to dissolve karma and error. Again, we go with this whole karma thing. I don't know why Saint Germain seems to be their prophet, their messiah, but again, going down the wrong road. Focus is not on Christ. Focus is not on loving your neighbor, forgiveness. Even in the Bible, God, the prophets, the apostles said you.
This podcast is supported by The Real Real. You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts, but not just any gifts, real gifts.
thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The RealReal. The RealReal is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something you're impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The RealReal. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention that everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
We'll suffer, and we all suffer in our own ways on a very regular basis, but God is there to help us get through and strengthen our faith. Number five, you're responsible for all energy you qualify. Every emotion, thought, or word is recorded in your aura. Again, more BS. This is just so occulty and new age. It blows my mind. Number six, the ascended masters are real. Beings like Jesus, Saint Germain, El Mora, all once walked the earth and now assist in higher planes. So again, now we're taking the deity of Jesus Christ and either reducing it and putting it on terms of other ascended masters, or taking these other people that at one point in time walk to earth, but once they die, they're not helping us anymore. They're somewhere else. They're heaven, hell, but they're taking these people who have passed on and putting them up to Christ's level. And last but not least, obedience to the great divine plan is the path of freedom. Harmony and universal law leads to ascension. Again, we go back to the Theosophist beliefs of karma, manifestation, taking principles from Eastern religions, Western religions, esotericism, and jumbling them all up to give this one theological viewpoint where everybody can look at it and say, yeah, that's cool, it makes sense. Buddha, Christ, whomever, they're all just different manifestations of God. And there couldn't be anything further from the truth, especially if you read the Bible and see what God says. God says, I am a jealous God, and there's only one way to heaven, is through Christ. So, man, there's just a list of key ascendant masters I'm going to go over. They also have core cosmology, the famous chart your life, chart your divine self. I'm not even going to look at it because I don't need to plague my mind with such silliness. And then there's the whole concept of the violet consuming flame, the heart of the practice, quote unquote. The purpose transmutates, quote unquote, burns away negative karma, discord, and human misqualification from past and present lives. So let's learn something new. So they believe in past lives, which again, not biblical. And they visualize a blazing violet fire with electric blue core surrounding the body. And there's some decrees, chants, I'm not going to read them. And they believe in the spoken word of creative power. So I don't even want to bore our audience with the other 10 principles they have, but you can see pretty quick that this is very occult, very new age.
Yeah, what I liked, and when I say like, I mean it ironically, was Balor's revelation that divine spark within every human could be awakened through decrees and violent flame rituals. And it spread fast. By what we saw was in the late 1930s, thousands were chanting invocations to the masters in hotel ballrooms and on mountain meadows. And the Balor's organization, the Saint Germain Foundation, still existed. Its temples dotted small towns across America, and each August, a pageant filled the Forest Amphitheater at Shasta Springs with music, banners, and violent light. Visitors described the spectacle as half revival, half opera. One former attendee remembers standing in a circle at dawn as hundreds of voices chanted, I am the light of the world! And the sound rolled down the slope and seemed to bounce back and from the peak and speak to them. And for a moment, she said, it felt like the mountain was answering her. Others found the experience unsettling. Strict schedules, rules against doubt, talk of total devotion to their supreme masters. The Ballard's 1940s mail fraud trial only heightened the movement's secrecy. Outsiders called it a cult, much like I do, and insiders called it proof of persecution. In the decades that followed, Shasta became a magnet for new iterations of that same hunger. Groups with names like the Summit Lighthouse and Church Universal and Triumphant set up conclaves near Lake Sissoko, blending the IM's fiery patriotism with a gentler New Age mysticism. Every few years, new light families arrived. Temporary communes promising ascension through diet, chanting, or crystal therapy. One former participant recalled being told to surrender her phone for a 3-day activation. We sang until we forget the time, she said. At first, it felt like a release, and then it felt like control. Locals see the pattern clearly. Each new wave arrives beneath the same clouds. Charismatic leaders, strict controls, borrowed by Wintu terminology, and a story that always begins with a revelation on the mountain. Residents really have grown wary, but rarely hostile. As one shopkeeper put it, they come looking for God, but they keep finding each other. Modern testimonies online still capture the mountain's pull. I cried so much I felt I was releasing a lifetime of trauma, one tourist wrote in her like vortex tour. Then I was filled with so much love, I didn't think my body could hold it all in. And another described her post-retreat glow. After the retreat, I was filled with so much joy and gratitude. I finally brought back my home to my true soul essence here in Mount Shasta. And this language repeats across websites and flyers, and this kind of soft rhythm of awakening and purification and homecoming. Yet, I think beneath the serenity lies the same structure that once made the I Am activity a lightning rod. Charismatic leaders, isolation from the outside world, and the mountain as unquestionable authority. A few locals that I saw whispered about a modern off-grid communities renting cabins for 11/11 activations, the same nights UFO hunters stake out the ridgeline. One neighbor recalls seeing a procession of white-robed figures walking towards Panther Meadow with torches. He said they look like ghosts out of old pageants, just quieter. From the indigenous Wintu elders, all of this attention cuts both ways. Panther Meadow, Portal Meadow, to the mystics, remains their most sacred site, a birthplace of creation. People come to heal, they said, but they don't ask who the mountain already belongs to. To her, the real ceremony is the one that's been held there for a millennia, not the one advertised on glossy posters and promising ascension to a higher authority. Now, I think what we see is today in Mount Shasta is both a shrine and a stage, a quiet volcano with a very busy imagination, a natural wonder layered with human longing. Its slopes host yoga mats and these violent flames. Its caves echo with chants and its skies fill with drones filming these clouds mistaken for ships. But from Ballard's first I Am decree to that modern star seed activation, every group that gathers here believes the same thing, that the mountain is awake and that it is listening. Now, it seems like pageantry to me. People want to believe in something and that faith is misplaced. I always think it takes a lot more faith to be an atheist or to believe in the Big Bang because you're just believing in one miracle. It's a lot easier to believe that we had a Christ that died for our sins and conquered the grave. To me, it's just easier. I have all the benefits and I have none of the bad outcomes that are already on your plate. But when you refuse to believe in the truth, you body, your soul, crave somewhere to put that. And I think sometimes people misrepresent that. They're putting their hope into something that is false and it's going to destroy them. And it's not going to give them the ability to conquer the grave through a perfect savior. So I think it's misplaced hope, what it ultimately boils down to. But weird thing to believe it, man. I find it a little bit shady, but there are some interesting stories coming out of there.
So, you know, you said that term 11/11, and that's a very new age occult time. And so essentially what it means, so many modern day occultists interpret seeing 11/11 repeatedly as synchronicity. It's a message from the universe, guardian spirits, or one's higher self to wake up. And it's also related to manifestation portals. So again, we go back to this. I know we're talking about an occult organization, so it shouldn't be a surprise that they use these numbers. And it's also an angelic number. So an angelic numerology popularized by Doreen Virtue and later mystics, 11/11 is said to mean your thoughts are manifesting rapidly. So these people are heavily involved into the occult manifestation. And I know we talked earlier about this kind of infiltrating the church, and we can do a different episode on that, but I guess you would call them more modern theologians and authors use that kind of new agey occult manifestation, and they tried to branch into Christianity. Like I said before, it's like the prosperity church, the power of positive thinking. So this has weaseled its way into modern day Christianity in some form or fashion. And it's unfortunately for the people who believe it, it's not a biblical teaching.
It kind of reminds me of the prosperity gospel. God's only here to do amazing things for you and make you super wealthy.
Yeah,
and
yeah, like forget
debts.
Heaven. Like you can get it all here. Like, you want some money? Just yeah. Donate to my church, listen to my message, buy my books, and you're all set. And then when the people do it and it doesn't work for 99.9% of the people, they lose faith in God. And it's because they're coming at it with the wrong intention, the wrong heart space. And it's just sad, man, because of the wolf's in sheep's clothing, man. They walk these people down the wrong path and they lose faith, and judgment's going to be harsh for them.
Yeah, 100%. When we're talking about these more modern stories connected to Mount Shasta, I got to tell my favorite one. So have you heard of the robot grandma in the flashing cave?
Yeah, I know a little bit about it, but please tell me. I want to hear your rendition.
So it began as a missing child alert in the summer of 2011. Another brief panic in the forest around McLeod Falls. A 30-year-old boy wandered away from his family's campsite, vanishing into the woods for several hours. I'm thinking about my son. He's right around that age and vanishing. My heart would break. I would be in a panic. I'd probably die of a heart attack wherever I found him because I'd be so scared. But anyways, when searchers finally found him near dusk, unharmed but dazed, his story was something no ranger could have scripted. He said his grandmother had found him, only it wasn't really her. She looked the same, but moved strangely, stiffly, like a puppet learning to walk. She led him by the hand through the trees into a cave where the air blinked with lights that came out of the walls. Inside, she asked him to lie on a table made of stone and began checking him, touching his head, his legs, and asking him really odd questions in a flat voice. He then fell asleep on this stone and woke up outside by the creek, sunlight in his eyes and the cave completely gone. When his family heard the story, confusion really gave way to this uneasy feeling. The grandmother he described had never left camp. She stayed there. The incident spread through online forums, folded into the missing 411 lore and late night podcast. Some said the boy was taken into Telios for testing. Others that he had wandered into a shapeshifter's den. The robot grandma became shorthand for a darker side of Shasta's portals, an intelligence that mimics what we love most to draw us deeper underground and into this story. To me, it sounds kind of like a demon. It seems weird that she's touching this kid. Perhaps she thought he was injured, or perhaps it was a kid that fell asleep had a crazy nightmare that he thought was real. Sometimes my kid has dreams and he wakes up in a panic and he thinks they're real. So I can see that occurring as well. But to me, that's just a super interesting story to frame it around 2011.
Yeah, that is an interesting story. Sometimes I wonder, he was three. So I don't know of many three-year-olds who can communicate all that well or tell grandiose stories. So I'm wondering if whoever he told this story to blew it out of proportion. Maybe he doesn't even know what a robot is. At three, I don't know. It just seems unlikely you would get this somewhat detailed story from a three-year-old kid who was, how long was he missing for again, did you say?
Basically like a night. He wandered away from camp and he was discovered around dusk.
Yeah. And you know how kids are. You know how we were when we were kids. You have these fantastic imaginations. At three, you probably don't know you did anything wrong by wandering away. You just know mom and dad are freaked out when they find you. And it almost sounds like the kid got lost. They found him. They were freaked out. He didn't really know what to tell them. So he made up probably a story based off the last cartoon he watched. I throw that out pretty quick.
I can't tell you, my son loves robots and he's three. He actually dressed up as a robot for Halloween just this past weekend. But could he tell a story like this? I imagine he could. All right. Perhaps he's worried he's going to get in trouble. So he misdirects it and tells a tall tale.
Yeah.
And maybe gets him out of trouble. So I could see it. But it also could be something deeper and far more scary, that there is a demon or there's something else that's percolating in the background. Because I can tell you, my kid communicates pretty well at three. He's able to tell stories. He's able to tell me what he saw, what he did for the day, all those kinds of things. So there is a probably less likely, but also a darker possibility that's associated with it.
Yeah, but trying to think in the past, I don't know of any stories, correct me if I'm wrong, audience, please, but I don't know of any stories where children are, like, I don't want to say kidnapped, but presented to by demons. I just don't think that if they are, I think the only ones that have happened are kids that are being sacrificed to idols thousands of years ago. And I don't, but that's because someone, i.e. their parents, are taking them to the altar to be sacrificed. I just don't know if demons particularly mess with kids. I'm not saying kids can't see stuff. I just don't know if they're messed with. I don't necessarily believe that they're allowed to be messed with at that age.
Possible. I don't know. I feel like kids are closer to God because God has a special place in his heart for them. And if he does, then I think the devil's kind of working on the counterpoint, trying to lead them astray before they establish that relationship.
Yeah, but I don't know. I'll have to do some research on that. I don't know of any stories about anyone under the age of 12 really being possessed, or maybe they act weird, or maybe they have some sort of mental illness or something. But I just don't know of any like verified stories about being kidnapped by spirits or being manifested to by spirits or being possessed by demons.
Yeah, it's a super interesting place because as we're obviously talking a lot about the I Am movement and the conspiracies connected to that. But I think beneath the mysticism runs a colder rumor that Mount Shasta hides not only the Lemurians, prisons, but laboratories. Conspiracy theorists map the area as home to what they say is DUMB, or DUMB, the deep underground military base burrowed into the mountain's core. They speak of an elevator shaft disguised as vents of camouflage, hangars hidden in glacier crevices, of hummings heard through the rock on quiet nights. In this version, the mountain's orbs and strange lights aren't spiritual at all. They're actually experimental aircraft, reverse engineered from recovered technology. Local accounts describe convoys of unmarked trucks entering forest service roads at odd hours, or the distant thump of machinery, which, you know, should only be silence. The legend folds neatly into the broader myth of Shasta's underground. Telios for the mystics, DUMB for the paranoids, two language for the same unease, and that something enormous and secret moves beneath our feet. Perhaps the boy was talking about a creature, perhaps he made up a story, or perhaps he ran into one of these underground tunnels and maybe met a government guy that was just trying to make sure he was okay and make his way home, and the story got twisted.
I guess it's a possibility. I know you've referenced David Pleiades, his missing 411, and I think one of the theories, and it's not proven, it's just speculation, is that these areas that have a cluster of missing people, usually it happens out in nature, someplace like Mount Shasta or somewhere in some forest. And one of the theories is that it coincides with like the deep underground military bases, that people wander into these areas and
want to make a difference in your community, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously, your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
They're just taken and released. I assume the conclusion is that they're just killed, and that way they can't share the knowledge of this. So if we believe that route, then, or if anyone believes that route, I guess that could be a pretty good explanation. Maybe they didn't have it in their heart to do anything bad to a three-year-old kid, and knowing that he's 3 years old, if they just put him back out, like, no one's gonna believe what he says anyways.
So
Mount Shasta is a volcano, and so there are tunnels that are like old lava flow tunnels. For someone to say they walked into a tunnel that was miles deep is not out of the question. It's frankly probably a good possibility that if somebody found one of these tunnels, they probably could walk through it for miles and miles. Mount Shasta is big, and as nature does its thing, it's carving out these tunnels just naturally.
Yeah, in my research, what I found was some people said the mountain hums because something's down there is running. The rumor of a DUMB, or a deep underground military base buried inside the volcano itself, and labyrinth of tunnels, freight elevators, and cold laboratories hidden beneath the snow. What I saw was truckers talk about unmarked convoys slipping into the forest roads at night, hikers telling of metallic vibrations underfoot and lights flickering behind the tree lines where no roads exist. Some even claim to have seen disguised vents releasing mist that isn't steam, or the faint pulse of radar where no towers stand. My research says the U.S. government, or some older, quieter power, has been conducting experiments under Shasta for decades, weather control, dimensional travel, or genetic engineering. Now, we've seen a lot of television documentaries and late night radio specials revisit this story every few years, looping the same drone footage over whispers of secrecy, and scientists ultimately dismiss it. Of course, just geothermal labs, nothing more. But in the towns that circle the mountain, people still swear they can feel the machinery humming far below, like the breath of a giant that never quite went to sleep. So there are a lot of people talking about government facilities down there. And one of the biggest things that they talk about with Mount Shasta is sightings of UFOs. Do you know any good stories about the UFOs and Mount Shasta?
I do, but I want to talk about this deep underground military base thing. So this is pretty interesting. So a leaked 1980s map of 129 DUMs listed Shasta as number 3, and the claim was that it's connected via high-speed maglev tunnels to bases like China Lake and 29 Palms, which is a Marine base. These tunnels allegedly span 1.5 to 3 miles deep, powered by geothermal vents or Shasta Lakes Dam. This leaked 1980s map claims that the Shasta base is 42 levels deep, housing 20,000 plus personnel. It even has livestock, apparently, in the tech labs. The entrances are hidden near lava tubes, like we talked about, near Flume Creek or Panther Meadows. So Shasta's deep underground bases are often portrayed as multifunctional. They blend military operations with occult horror. And here's a breakdown. So one of the theories is it's a mind control hub from the Monarch program. So a brief description, the base broadcasts holographic alien communications. Here we go back to Bluebeam to induce mass delusions, reprogramming CIA MK Ultra Monarch slaves. So essentially the claim is that these slaves are traffic victims turned to assassins. Captives arrive via black helicopter or flying saucers. This gets really fantastical, just to warn everybody, but it's fun to think about. And the facilities include torture chambers with high-tech VR gear. This kind of came from Kathy O'Brien's Transformation of America back in 1995, and it describes the largest mind control center in the country. There's also a claim of ET collaboration and trafficking, and we'll have to do a deep dive on Phil Schneider. I'm not even going to ask you if you heard about him, but he's got some pretty fantastic claims, but he's dead now under very mysterious circumstances. But the claim from Phil was that these underground labs host gray reptilians for hybrid experiments, and they traffic children and are harvesting adrenochrome for slave labor. So again, the fantastical, even to a certain extent, like almost unbelievable. It's also claimed that it's a doomsday tech bunker for elite survival. It's an elite survival vault with aerospace R&D, specifically anti-gravity craft and bioweapons labs, which I would believe that out of all these theories so far. And then this is probably, if not the most fantastical, very close. It's an Antian Lumerian prison. This kind of theory merged with Shasta's myths, Atlantean sealed Lumerians and pleasure palaces, and the dumb overlords exploit this for psychic tech. And I am not being tongue-in-cheek when I say dumb, because it's pretty dumb.
Oh no, getting locked up in a pleasure palace?
It doesn't even make sense. You're going to put someone in an awesome prison? Like, I don't get it.
Yeah, one of the things you mentioned was the reptilian bases at the base of the volcano. And obviously, a lot of us hear about, there is a conspiracy theory going on out there that I think is quite wild, where, you know, a lot of the government figures are actually reptilian, and they do really bad things to children and stuff. But I think as we trace it back, right, deep beneath the glacier fields of Mount Shasta, supposedly another race stirs, the reptilians. In this chapter of the lore, Shasta isn't just home to the Lemurians or the Atlanteans, but to an entirely separate species of scaled subterranean beings. Some versions call them the ancient earthlings, descendant of dinosaurs who evolved into intelligence and retreated underground after the planet's last great extinction. Others say they've off-world colonies who arrived eons ago, tunneling beneath volcanoes to harvest geothermal energy. They're described as tall, cold-eyed, and telepathic, moving through heat-proof tunnels lit by bioluminescent fungi. Conspiracy theories map their lairs alongside military bases, suggesting covert alliances between governments and the reptilian overlords. In this web, Shasta becomes this junction of Lemurian light above, reptilian shadow below. The two civilizations coexist uneasily, ancient rivals sharing the same mountain, each guarding its secrets. And every few years, hikers report a metallic smell or a flash of greenish light deep in the crevices. Now, to scientists, it's sulfur gas, and to believers, it's something far older, proof that the mountain's cold heart is still beating with those of its first inhabitants.
And some people tie some of the disappearances, which we'll have to talk about, to these Bigfoot stories.
Yeah, that's interesting. So we have Bigfoot, which we've seen countless places across. We have giants, we have Lemurians, and even before the UFOs and before the talk of the lost continents, the tribes of Northern California already told stories about the Wagas, the little people, the starfolk, the Watchers who live between worlds. Among the Wintu, the Kirku, and the Shasta tribes, these beings were neither ghosts nor gods, but something in between. Small, luminous figures who emerged at night from stones or mist, bringing knowledge from the stars. Some tales describe them as ancestors, others as travelers who came down on beams of light to teach songs or survival skills and then returned to the heavens. Modern mystics have folded these stories into Shasta's cosmic mythology. The Walgast are now cast as pre-Lemurian beings, guardians who, you know, keep the gates of the mountain before Telios was even imagined. In this retelling, they are the caretakers of the portals, and the invisible but ever-present, protecting the delicate balance between our world and whatever lies beneath. Campers sometimes report feeling watched on the slopes. Glimpses, flashes of pale figures darting between the rocks, and some call them spirits, and others call them the first witnesses to everything that came after. So we have sightings of very tall people, and very short people, and giants, and discovery of skeletons, and I think we even talked about the Starfolk in the Grand Canyon episode when we were going down that trail. And they say, through the ley line, that the Grand Canyon to Mount Shasta is connected, so perhaps we have some connective tissue there.
Yeah, man. So I think this is a good transition into the missing people stories. So we can talk about Carl Landers a bit if you want to take that, or I can take that. It's up to you.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, so Carl Landers was born in December 29, 1929. He was a fit, adventurous retiree and former school board member. He was an avid outdoorsman. He was a marathon runner, a technical climber, and a peak bagger aiming to summit the highest point in every California county. So this guy was fairly experienced with climbing mountains, and he was obviously very fit. He was a bit older when he disappeared. I think he was 69 when he disappeared. So on May 21st, 1999, he arrived in the area with two lifelong climbing buddies, Barry Gilmore and Milton Gaines, both from Orinda. They stayed at a motel in Mount Shasta City, and they drove to the trailhead at Bunny Flat, which is an elevation of 8,100 feet. So you can do the math there. There's about another 6,000 plus feet they have to get to the summit. So outline the timeline of his disappearance. So the events unfolded pretty rapidly on a clear, calm morning, which kind of made the vanishing a little bit more inexplicable. So on May 21st through May 24th, the group acclimates at the motel. No issues reported. They hike to Camp 1 near Helen Lake at an elevation of 10,400 feet and set up base. So on May 25th at camp, Carl complains of feeling poorly. It probably was altitude sickness, which is not uncommon at that elevation. So he decides to push ahead alone to a flat bare spot on Helen Lake, about 900 to 1,000 feet uphill from camp, to rest and catch his breath. So he's last seen in full view wearing a rust-colored jacket, ski pants, hiking boots, and crampons, gloves, and a backpack with food, water, and gear. And he didn't really show many signs of distress. And that was around 9 a.m. So between 9:30 and 10, Barry and Mitt finish packing and follow the same trail. Visibility is good. The path is well marked. Open snowfield with no cliffs, no dense woods, and no hiding spots. So at 10 a.m., his partners reach Helen Lake. Carl is gone. They can't find any footprints, gear, or tracks in the fresh snow, so they start searching and they can't really find anything. The partners hiked the entire route that day, summoning and descending, calling for Carl en route. They reported him missing upon returning to the trailhead around 6 p.m. So this time, the Shasta County Sheriff's Office gets involved, and they launch a massive operation on May 26, coordinated by the U.S. Forest Service and the county search and rescue. So this is a pretty big effort. Over 100 personnel, including helicopters with thermal imaging, ground teams, cadaver dogs, and climbers, covered 12 plus square miles, including the crevices, gullies, and off-trail areas. Veteran rescuer Grizz Adams, who had 20 plus years on Shasta, led all the efforts probing the lakes and caves. So this search lasted 10 days, with intermittent sweeps through the summer of 1999 and spot checks into the 2000s. So there was a pretty big recovery effort to try to find this fella, and they didn't find anything. No clothes, no backpack, no body, obviously. And Carl's car remained at the trailhead. So he didn't go back. He didn't pop into his car and didn't roll out. The case went cold and reclassified as a missing person by the Department of Justice later that year. As of 2025, he's listed as a missing person with no updates. So what do you think? What do you make of that, brother?
You ever heard of the 60-foot hole that won't go away?
Tell me, I don't think I have.
So years ago, climbers discovered a mysterious hand-dug shaft on Mount Shasta's flank, which was this neat circular bore about 15 feet wide and 60 feet deep, descending straight into the rock. Authorities later filled it in for what they called safety. That story kind of refuses to be buried. What was it? A treasure tunnel? A secret entrance to Telios? An unfinished experiment? Nobody really agrees, and I think that's the beauty of it. The Shasta hole has become a mirror for the imagination. The Warshar's test of ice and stone. And perhaps, maybe he fell down the 60-foot hole.
Where was the hole, though? This guy was pretty high up in the elevation.
Yeah, they say this is pretty high up, so they didn't point to exactly where it was. But I don't know. A lot of this Mount Shasta stuff connects to the hollow earth theory that people love to talk about that I don't necessarily believe in. It started somewhere, I guess, mid-mountain, and folks could fall down in it. So the government covered it up. I could not find the exact location on a map or in a document, but somewhere up there in this mythical mountain.
Yeah, I feel like, so Grizz Adams, I feel like with 20 plus years on Mount Shasta, and especially near the peak, he would have known where that hole was and would have probably searched that pretty quickly if it was up that high. For some reason, I don't know if that hole, I know what the hole you're talking about is. It almost sounds like something like a prospector would dig, even though it wouldn't make a lot of sense for a prospector to dig it up mid-mountain, because I watched enough Gold Rush to know that all the gold tends to lie in river beds, creek beds, or beds of the sort that dry up over time. So to dig a hole that high up, that far away from a creek bed wouldn't make a whole lot of sense. But who knows? Maybe you had an experienced miner or somebody who thought they found something. But to dig 60 feet is a pretty big commitment.
I meant it as more in tongue-in-cheek, because I think some of this stuff about Mount Shasta is pretty fantastical. Have you heard about the interdimensional Sasquatch?
I think we talked a little bit about Sasquatch, and a lot of people do believe, even modern theorists now, a lot of these conspiracy shows and podcasts actually think Sasquatch is an interdimensional being. And they're serious about it.
Yeah, you take a shirt off and run out in the woods, people think might think they see
Manscaped right now, brother. I look like a human, but give it 6 months, am I not?
Yeah, this one is fantastical, though. So Bigfoot is a creature of footprints and obviously folklore, but on Mount Shasta, he's a glitch in reality. Witnesses tell of hulking silhouettes crossing pumice flats, their steps heavy, but their tracks fading halfway across the open ground. Others describe orbs of light pacing the tree line before revolving into a giant fur-covered forms that shimmer and vanish. It's as if the creature steps between the layers of the world, half in our realm and half in another. Old tribal stories speak of wild men or shadow guardians who could move unseen, protecting sacred places. And modern witnesses reframe them as interdimensional travelers, beings who slip through the same portals the Lemurians use to reach Telios. Some cryptid hunters have recorded sudden temperature drops, flashes of static, and magnetic interference whenever sightings occur. And few claim to have heard low-frequency vibrations in the air and a hum that feels more mechanical than animal. I think in Shasta's myth, Bigfoot isn't really a missing link. It's a messenger, a gatekeeper of the broader between natural and like the supernatural. Every broken branch or this kind of echoing howl becomes a reminder that some myths just don't walk among us. They phase right through us.
Yeah, old Bigfoot. I'd love to have somebody on the show that's like a big Bigfoot expert. That'd be so cool to interview someone like that. I'm on the fence with Bigfoot, man. I'm not real sure what I think it is. There have been people who claim to have recovered like fur and they got DNA out of it and it came back as something unknown. I tend to believe it's something natural. It's just a species that's like the North American ape or something that is just, you know, so rare that it's hard to find. And they're probably a little smarter than the average animal. But I don't know. It's a super, super interesting topic. And I would like to do a deep dive on it. But with my hand being held with somebody who's a quote unquote expert or has at least sufficient knowledge on it. So Mount Shasta is like widely regarded as one of the most active interdimensional portal zones on Earth, a place where the veil is thin between physical reality and higher dimensions. And it also says that it's a portal to parallel timelines, and it's supposedly exceptionally thin. These portals are not physical doors, but energy vortexes or energy vortices, electromagnetic anomalies. And the claim is that they're consciousness gateways as well, and that they allegedly allow beings, aka Lemurians, ETs, Ascendant Masters, I hate that word, and cryptids to enter and exit, and occasionally humans to slip through. The concept kind of blends indigenous shamanism, obviously theosophy, ufology, and quantum physics. So it gets a little crazy. You talked about the ley lines earlier. The claim is that the ley lines amplify this high frequency energy, essentially created from the volcanic rock, amplifies scalar waves, and it can act as a portal to somewhere else. There are apparently seven major portals. So Panther Meadows has an elevation of 7,600 feet. It's the primary Earth portal, and the known activity is the Lemurian entry exit, UFO landings, and time slips. You have one at Heart Lake, which is at 9,200 feet. This is apparently the contact portal. You have Helen Lake, which oddly enough is where Carl was at 10,400 feet, and they call this the disappearance portal. I think you need more than one person to disappear up there to call it a disappearance portal. Poor Carl Landers, but just because one guy had the unfortunate circumstance disappearing doesn't mean that there was a portal. You have the gateway near Thumb Rock, and it's called the Ascension Portal, and this is where they claim Saint Germain and the violet flame activations happened. Then you have Pluto's Cave. It's at 4,200 feet, so a little bit lower on the mountain. It's apparently an underground portal to reptilian Lemurians and deep underground military base access. You have Castle Lake, 5,500 feet, and it's apparently the water portal where people have claimed to have seen underwater lights and things of the sort. And then last but not least, you have McLeod River Falls at 3,500 feet, and it's apparently the elemental portal. And that's where people have heard sound anomalies and have seen fairies. So a lot of this to me just screams esoteric kind of nonsense. But I think to cover this topic, we had to bring it up. So there are a couple famous portal incidents. There's one at Panther Meadows. In 1987, a group of 12 meditators saw a 7-foot robe step out of thin air, walk 20 feet, and vanish into the meadows. I'm curious as to if they were doing mushrooms or not. 2016, Ricardo Gonzalez led an expedition and used telepathic coordinates to open a portal and claimed a triangular craft appeared on cue, filmed by 40 witnesses. I didn't check to see if that was confirmed, but I'm guessing some sort of drugs or some sort of psychotic break was involved. And in 2023, a hiker reported time dilation. He claimed to have left at 2 p.m., returned at 6, but his watch only showed 30 minutes had passed. So that's a little interesting to me. That kind of piques my curiosity, whether or not that's true or not. I guess he would only know. So the portal Heart Lake is a CE5 hotspot. So in 2021 to 2025, monthly human-initiated contact events using Dr. Stephen Greer's protocols. Again, I don't even want to get into Stephen Greer, but they claim to have summoned orbs and light shifts. One video from 2024 shows a golden Merkaba spinning over the lake. So I'm not even getting into the mechanisms of Stephen Greer's protocols because I think it's a cult. And I think when you start dabbling in the cult, you can summon stuff. So I don't even want to get into that. And then there's, obviously, like we talked about Carl, you have the Helen Lake, the vanishing zone. Sometimes I think these people get disoriented or there's some other underlying cause that make them get a bit disoriented, which is curious. But at the same time, I just feel like these one-off cases are by no means evidence.
Yeah, what's interesting about Panther Meadow, known among the mystics as the Portal Meadow, it sets high on Mount Shasta's southern slope, and it's a stretch of soft grass and wildflowers fed by a spring so pure, the Wintu people have worshipped it for centuries. To the Wintu, this is the birthplace of humanity. The axe is where the creator shaped the world, and to the New Age seekers, it's a stargate, a vortex, a place where time and light seem to thin. Now that meadow has been placed under new protective orders, beginning August 14th of 2024 and lasting until August 14th of 2026, the U.S. Forest Service has enacted restrictions, limited group sizes, prohibitions on stepping into the springs, and leash laws for animals. The update, issued in March 25, is meant to protect fragile habitats, but to believers, it reads like something else. They call it guarding the doorway, this bureaucratic echo of the ancient ideal that the gate must be watched. The roles may be simple, but the mythic language of Shasta, even an ordinance, can feel like a sign. And when government red tape comes in and makes people start to guess of what's really happening there. Now, there is obviously a lot of rumors, a lot of tales, and a lot of stories. How much is confirmed, I don't know. But it seems like there could be seeds of truth if so many people are collectively talking about it. Now, I know there's also a culture in some of these hippie communes and hippie villages that you go up there that they do a lot of mushrooms and they do get very high as they worship the mountains. It could be a mix of things. If people think and they see something that's not really there and maybe something going on.
So anything else you want to explore on this topic? Because I'm just getting a lot of occult stuff, getting a pretty big occult vibe.
Yeah, so I think one of the interesting things that I found in my research was the new monument on Shasta's doorstep. Just northeast of Mount Shasta, the Medicine Lake Highlands have taken on a new name and a new life. And I can't pronounce this name, but I think it's something along the lines of Satatia Highlands National Monument, which was established in 25. Spanning more than 224,000 acres of volcanic terrain, lava beds, obsidian domes, and this kind of vast labyrinth of cave. The monument preserves land that both scientists and storytellers have long claimed as sacred. For indigenous communities, it's a cradle of origin and ceremony, and for mystics, it's an extension of Shasta's unseen architecture. Another piece of planetary power grid. The Highlands honeycomb of the lava tubes has been mapped and named in local folklore as the underground labyrinth, a rumored corridor linking Shasta to distant hollow earth cities. Even NASA once trained astronauts here, testing equipment in the alien landscapes of basalt and glass, which only fueled the legend further. Now, with federal protections ensuring that the terrain remains untouched, both history and mystery kind of coexist. And tourists come for the geologies. Seekers come, obviously, for the energy. I think either way, this new monument expands Shasta's mythic frontier and another gate on the map of the mountain that really never runs out of entrances.
Yeah, I think to do the topic justice, we kind of have to touch on UFOs a bit. So I didn't know this, but Mount Shasta is the number 13 UFO hotspot in the U.S. So apparently there's 600 plus documented sightings between 1947 and 2025. The most recent one was from the IAM group, claimed to see a violet beam from the summit that lasted, I think, 7 minutes, and it had 1,200 plus witnesses, and apparently it's on 4K video and thermal cam. So this is where my belief in Christ and the Bible comes into play. I think people can summon demons and can summon things, especially with intention, that are not what you think they are. So again, here we are with people conflating one thing for something else. So it's not shocking that these 1,200 plus people saw something and recorded it. I just don't think it's something good. Also, on October 19th, 2025, this year, there was a phone video of a tic-tac over McLeod Falls. It was recorded by three hikers. Again, so I can just keep reading these off just in the past year or two. So there is something crazy going on up there. And the one weird thing that I ran across was there was a quote by an anonymous Shasta ranger, and he was quoted as saying, "I've seen things up there that don't fit any manual, lights that follow you, footprints that stop, people who walk into the mist and don't come out. The mountain isn't haunted, it's awake." I don't know. It seems like something metaphysical or supernatural may be happening up there. But I think, like with anything in this world, man, like you start seeing some of these phenomena, and I don't think they are what you think there. I don't think it's aliens. I don't think it's cryptids. I don't think it's you're seeing people, ascended masters, phasing in and out of reality. I think it's demons playing their games. And in this case, probably being summoned by these people who want to see them.
Yeah, it's a good point. As far as I'm concerned, I think Mount Shasta is like the leading place in the United States where people see UFOs. And it's very common. You could Google search it and you could probably come up with some video that's showing. I don't know if there's anything concrete that says, hey, these are aliens visiting our world. It is ironic how it's close to Area 51, it's close to the Grand Canyon. It's close to these areas that we see a whole lot of activity. I might as well cover it because it's on our podcast, ARP, but it's like what people call the clouds that park like ships. So on still afternoons when lights lean gold over the Cascades, Mount Shasta's summit often wears a strange crown, a stack of clouds. Silver disc layered like saucers. Meteorologists call them standing wave clouds, formed when moist air rides up the mountain, hits the colder layers, and folds back on itself. Scientifically explainable. But legends don't stop there. The local and spiritual tourists alike say those aren't clouds so much as a mothership. hidden in plain sight, resting above the summit and waiting. Lights have been claimed beneath them, descending the ridges, slipping into twilight, and photographers snap images of perfect disc shapes, flawless symmetry, and they call them UFO clouds. The lore of Telios of a subterranean cities and hidden doorways, such as clouds, are highways or parking bays for crafts that, you know, kind of travel between dimensions. The mountain becomes not only a sacred site, but also an airfield to the unseen. Hikers who pause at dusk, silhouette after silhouette, sometimes hear the hum of something unclassified. They set up tripods and cameras, and they whisper about ships parked in the sky. The myth and the meteorology merge. These discs become more than weather. They become symbols that coexist together of our outer world and our inner world, of the mundane and the miraculous, that Shasta skies open up just enough to let the myth breathe. Now, I've seen pictures of these. They're pretty interesting, though I don't know that I would ever confuse them for UFOs, but there are a whole lot of sightings out there.
Yeah. So what do you think Mount Shasta is, man? What's your conclusion?
I spent hours upon hours pouring in research into Mount Shasta. My conclusion is I don't know. And I'm okay saying that I don't know. I think there's a lot of interesting things that are going on out there. Some may be things we can't quantify. Perhaps it's Bigfoot, and people call it Bigfoot, but perhaps it's like a bear standing on their back legs. I don't really know. But there's a lot of interesting stuff going on out there, and I don't know if we'll ever know. I think the mystics want to believe it's something that it's not. I do believe that the cults think this mountain is something, and I just don't see any research that supports their conclusions about Lemuria or Atlantis or aliens or any of this stuff that's circulating. But I do think there's a lot of weirdness going on out there. It's not a place I would want to walk alone at night, whether it be because the cults are going to grab you or something's going to grab you, or you're going to fall into a lava tube or whatever the case may be. But it's a whole lot of strangeness that it's hard for me to classify. But I just say approach these subjects easily. You can believe in some things. You don't have to believe in all things, and keep your heart centered on God. What about you?
Yeah, I struggle with it too. There seems to be a lot of occult, aka demonic, activity out there. So I know historically, both biblically and through other religious texts, both oral and the ones that are written down, angels tend, when they leave their original habitat and come down to earth, they tend to land on mountains, which is an interesting fact. Like 200 watchers, when they descended from heaven, they landed on top of Mount Hermon. I'm wondering if it's not some sort of area where demons, fallen angels are at, like their presences, and with all these occultists and theosophists and the offshoots of them are in their own way worshiping them and asking to see them, and so they're manifesting some pretty gnarly things. I also too think it is a volcanic mountain, so I wonder how much of it can be explained by physics and geomagnetic phenomena. It's a place that I think as of 200 years ago, it erupted. So I think that kind of takes away the possibility that there's an underground city there. I think if it's erupted, anything underneath it would have been long destroyed. And there have been several eruptions in the past 1,000 years. So it's not like it's been a dormant mountain for 1,000 years. So there's been enough destruction and eruptions to have destroyed whatever was underneath there. Do I believe it? No, but it's fun to think about maybe some deep underground military bases there. I think the possibility is slim. I do think they exist around the country, but do they exist there? I just don't think there's enough evidence to suggest that, but lean toward the spiritual demonic type presence that people are summoning with their intentions. We talked about people's intentions with our demonic doll episode, and I think this falls in that category.
I've seen the mountain before, not up close and personal, but driving or flying near it. I've seen the mountain, and sometimes things that are absolutely beautiful, that are absolutely majestic, you give it enough time, it breeds really interesting stories that people want to tell and connect to it and feel like they belong by telling these tales around a fire. So I think everything that is beautiful or majestic that God has created, eventually people start telling tales about it. And it is. It's a beautiful thing to see when you're out on the West Coast. But I don't know, man. I think there's probably some demonic things that are going on out there, as they always are when they're tied to cults. I think the possibility of a military base is probably the most plausible explanation for things that are going on out there. A lot of the things that went on with Area 51 are experimental aircrafts that you're seeing. So perhaps people are seeing experimental aircrafts. We know the military did training out there. We know NASA did training out there as well. So I think it's the most plausible explanation for some of these sightings that people are seeing. And then it's just, I think, the science that people don't understand. If we're talking about meteorology with the cloud formations above the mountain and what caused it, if you're already gone down a rabbit hole, you're not going to listen to the layman's science. You're going to want to breathe the myth that goes along with it.
So
we hope you have a peaceful night. Keep the feed strong. Like, subscribe, follow, comment on our videos. You people out in Miami, tell us why, how you heard about us, how you're following along with us. We would love to know. Sign up, man. We'll have some good conversations in the future.
We've hit the 0 hour. That's a wrap on this week's transmission. New episodes drop weekly, so stay tuned and don't miss the next signal. Follow, subscribe, and spread the word. You've been listening to Zero Signal. We're out.